Once again, the great richness of the liturgy is set before us. One of the first things that strikes me is that yesterday we celebrated Our Lady of Sorrows, and today's gospel is a woman of sorrow, the widow of Nain. How can you not make the comparison? Mary was a widow whose only son was killed, died on the cross, and here this nameless widow of Nain, her only son is dead, and Jesus responds with compassion. Well, that's one easy starting point. Another very easy starting point, if you want to take a liturgical perspective, is the saints today, Saints Cornelius and Cyprian, great heroic bishops. Well, Cornelius was a pope, Cyprian bishop in Africa. Great martyrs, heroic martyrs, inspiring examples of church leaders. And then it goes very well with today's first reading, in which St. Paul tells Timothy about what a good bishop is and what good bishops are, what good deacons are. So that's an easy starting point as well. But for some reason, what stood out to me is the psalm today. We have excerpts from Psalm 101. Psalm 101 is a psalm that is the expression of the right way of a ruler, or the ideal of a ruler, a king. Part of what made it stand out to me is that Psalm 101 was in today's morning prayer. If you pray the Liturgy of the Hours, it happens that Tuesday in the fourth week of the cycle, Tuesday morning prayer, one of the psalms is 101. So I said, oh, here came up again when I was praying morning prayer. Now, in this liturgy today, we only take excerpts from the psalm, but one of the things that stands out is the emphasis on the heart and on the eyes. I will walk with blameless heart, and I will use my eyes properly. And the eyes, of course, are the window of the soul, and what we look at is what we allow to be planted in our hearts. In fact, in our icon prayer every day, we say to Mary, open the eyes of our hearts with your faith. So our hearts also have eyes. But anyway, there's a lot of, the eyes are mentioned three times in the psalm. The heart is mentioned maybe three or four times. Yeah, but the contrast between the wrong use of the eyes, the eyes that are focused on base things, or eyes that are haughty, and then the right use of the eyes, the ruler says, my eyes are upon the faithful of the land. In other words, my eyes are not on what I can gain for myself or what's of worthless or evil, but my eyes are on my concern for my people. In other words, concern for others, other-centeredness. So now when we talk about the eyes, of course, our eyes are constantly being exposed to all sorts of things. We just came from a pilgrimage to Canada, and traveling around, you see so many things. One of the things that I'm always kind of debating within myself when we pray on the bus, should I close my eyes and focus on the prayer, or should I have my eyes open and see the beauty of nature? We were praying one time, we were driving up along the coast of Seneca Lake, one of the Finger Lakes, beautiful. It's just so beautiful. How could you not look at it? I said, that's a right thing to do. Give praise to God for the beauty of creation. But it's also right to focus on the inner life and take that in, and then close our eyes and say, well, I'm also focusing on the beauty of God and of his mysteries. So, but when we got up to Montreal, it turned out to be a very beautiful city. Aside from the beauty of the churches and the shrines, the city itself had a kind of a natural beauty to it. But it was also the world, secular world, and I don't know if others noticed, but there's a lot of immodesty among the people who, the Canadians apparently, and maybe this is every modern secular city. I don't notice it so much in the Philippines, but boy, the Canadians are not very modest people. And of course, we were staying at a secular hotel with a swimming pool, so that's another matter for modesty and what we look at, what we do with our eyes. So the psalmist says here, I will walk with blameless heart within my house. Okay, my house, but also in my inner life. I will protect my heart. And I will not set before my eyes any base thing. I looked up that word base because what is base? It could be translated as worthless or wicked or vile or base. It's a word, you know, bad stuff. And I could have put bad things before my eyes. And I find that to be very relevant to modern times, not only our trip through Canada and Montreal, but everybody is being exposed constantly to worthless things. And when we put worthless or base or wicked things before our eyes, that our hearts get, if not distracted, they could be attracted to what is not worthy of us. Isn't that the story of social media? I mean, it's not all evil, but a lot of it is worthless. And it attracts the eye. Last night I went out to buy a few things at the CVS, the pharmacy. By the time I got back, I had an email from CVS with ads for other things I should have bought. And I, you know, things that I probably would never have thought of, I never would have bought, but then it's on sale, you get 50% off. And like, it planted in my heart, I should go back to CVS and buy some more stuff. I said that I even looked at this stupid thing is almost embarrassing. I don't want, you know, fragrant lotions and whatever other beauty products. But this is it. I mean, this is what advertising does. It sets before our eyes what is base, not to mention the violence in the social media, the pornography, the attacks on other, you know, the wickedness, the materialism, the greed. I mean, this is what our eyes are exposed to. So the question is, well, what about our hearts? Are we protecting our hearts to be blameless? That's what a good ruler does. That's what a good bishop does. That's what a good deacon does. That's what a good Christian does. Protects the heart. Well, okay, so we could talk a lot about custody of the eyes and custody of the heart. What came to my mind just as an example, since the first reading focuses on what a bishop does and what a bishop doesn't do, I thought of the last bishop that I met in person. Perhaps I shared this already, but shortly before I came to the States, I was on a retreat. I was helping on a retreat for the members of Courage. I wasn't the retreat master, but I was just the assistant. Anyway, the bishop of the place where we had the retreat, it's in a diocese just to the south of Metro Manila, Archdiocese of Lipa. The bishop, when he heard that we were having our retreat in his diocese, he invited us to his house for dinner. It was extraordinary. Archbishop Garcera, who's been a very, very strong supporter of the Courage Apostolate, he invited all the retreatants. So there were over 30 of us. And so he invited us to his house and gave us a very nice dinner, catered dinner. And he sat with us, ate with us, and he asked different retreatants to share a little bit about their journey. And then he gave a little exhortation. It was really a beautiful evening and a beautiful example of a bishop. Here's a bishop who's irreproachable. He was not married only once. He never married, obviously, but temperate, self-controlled, decent, hospitable, able to teach, not a drunkard. I'm not canonizing the guy, but this Archbishop Garcera is a good model of what a pastor should do, what a bishop should do. In fact, more than you would ever expect an archbishop to just take in people and give them a dinner. And I'm sure he's got lots of other things to do. But that was a beautiful thing. And Archbishop Garcera has been elected by his fellow bishops as the president of the Bishops' Conference of the Philippines. So he's not only the archbishop of his own diocese, but now he has, or will have, come December, I think his term begins, he will have a kind of responsibility for the whole country and for the interaction of the church with the state, because the president of the Bishops' Conference is the one who addresses public issues and that sort of thing. So that's a big responsibility, and you want to have a good bishop to represent the whole church in the whole country. So that just comes to my mind as a good example of what St. Paul is talking about here, someone who knows how to be a pastor. I don't know if it should go into it here, but this reading about bishops and about deacons is a little bit poorly translated here. In this reading, it says that the bishop should be married only once and that the deacons should be married only once. What it really says is the bishops and the deacons should be husband of only one wife, which sounds like the same thing, but it's specifically about men and their wives. It's not about just being only married once, because if you know, there's a trend that wants to promote women deacons and even women bishops. And if you say a bishop should be married only once, it doesn't refer to a man or a woman. So it's a weak translation, married only once. Then where it says, it brings up the women in the section on the deacons. Some people have tried to say, oh, that's about women deacons. It's not about women deacons. It's about the wives of the deacons. The wives. It says women, but it's usually translated as wives. So in other words, the deacon and his wife should be examples of Christian life. So it's not about... And it's just striking that the reading actually specifically speaks about men who are pastoral leaders, not just anyone, not just people, but men. And in the church, we do recognize that the Lord reserves the sacramental roles of leadership to men, bishops, deacons, priests. There are also very important roles of women in the church, of course, and they're being better recognized. But this passage is about men, specifically about men. Now, we can apply it to everybody, lay people, men, women. We're all supposed to be self-controlled and decent and hospitable. We're all supposed to be we're not supposed to be addicted to drink or addicted to anything. We're not supposed to be slanderers or irresponsible in our households. But anyway, my focus though is based on the psalm: what we do with our eyes and what we do with our hearts. A good leader has his eyes not on what he can gain for himself. A good Christian has his or her eyes on not what he can gain for himself or herself, but on the needs of the other, willingness to be at the service of others. And of course, the best example of this is Jesus himself. So let's take a look at Jesus and his response to seeing this poor widow who has lost her only son. It says it beautifully. He sees this funeral procession and he's moved with pity for her. Not for him, for her, the mother, the widow. He's moved with pity for her. He's not looking at her as a way to advance his own plan or to do anything for himself. He's not avoiding her because she's going to be a burden on him. He's moved with compassion. His heart is moved with compassion. He sees with his eyes, he sees with his heart the needs of the poor woman. And he responds. First of all, he says, don't cry. He touches the coffin, which in the Jewish tradition would make him unclean. You don't touch coffins. You don't touch bodies. You don't touch anything to do with the dead because it will make you unclean. But of course, Jesus reverses that contamination of uncleanness. He, instead of becoming unclean, he brings life to the dead. And the people's response is, after the miracle, a great prophet has arisen in our midst, and God has visited his people. What we can learn from this is that when we look with compassion at the suffering, God reveals himself in our midst. God reveals himself through our compassion. Now it doesn't happen, usually, that when we have compassion, we raise people from the dead. And that's obviously a divine work, although it can happen, and we know it happens in the lives of the saints. But the exhortation we can take from this is we should look at the suffering the way Jesus looks at this woman, with a heart moved for the plight of the other. Because when we do that, then we can become a channel of God's presence to them. You know, when we see suffering people, and we've been praying for a lot of suffering people on our pilgrimage, and there's been a lot of intentions presented to us, people really, really burdened with suffering. I just heard a story of one of the relatives of the Amises, a man who's just got so many crosses. And you say, well, gosh, I don't know what to do about that. I can't help the guy. So that tendency to say, well, that, you know, I can't do anything. I'll just back off. I'll just forget about that. No, to be moved with compassion is to say, well, I'll focus on this intention. I'll lift this man up to prayer and his family and his concerns. At least for a moment, Lord, say, Lord, have mercy. Become a channel of God's compassion for the guy. And in that way, even if we don't seem to gain anything for ourselves, God has visited his people. So that's how I'm interpreting this for us. We can't walk around touching coffins and raising people from the dead. I mean, it's possible, but that's not usually our ministry. But we can touch people with compassion and with intercession, with prayer, with hearts moved for the good of others. We can do that. And when we do, God visits his people. So that's how, when our eyes are open to the dignity and the need of others, and when our hearts are moved with compassion, God is in our midst.